The 13th Amendment was passed by Congress on January 31, 1865. It was ratified on December 6th later that year. But Mississippi has a difficult relationship with it. And I'm taking this from a CBS News article. The 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which abolished slavery, was ratified in 1865. Lawmakers in Mississippi, however, only got around to officially ratifying the amendment last month. This is a 2013 article. 148 years later. Thanks to the movie Lincoln, the state's historical oversight came to light after Mississippi resident Runjan Batra saw the Steven Spielberg-directed film last November. The Clarion Ledger reports, after watching the film, which depicts the political plight to pass the 13th Amendment, Batra did some research. He learned that the amendment was ratified after three-fourths of the states backed in December 1865. Four remaining states eventually ratified and amended the amendment, except for Mississippi. Mississippi voted to ratify the amendment in 1995, but failed to make it official by notifying the U.S. Archivist. I read that article because Runjan Batra is a Unitarian Universalist in Mississippi. It's easy looking at the history of Mississippi to assume that this might have been done on purpose. Maybe it was, I don't know, but the fact they don't vote on it until 1995 tells me that historically the state wasn't very motivated to pass it anyway. I couldn't find anything about why it took that long specifically, but on a website called The History of Racial Injustice, it says this for March 16, 1995. More than a century later, in 1994, a clerk in the Texas legislature named Gregory Watson discovered that Mississippi still had not ratified the 13th Amendment. It goes on to say that they contacted the African-American members of the legislature, and then the legislature held a ceremonial vote. This surprised me. I didn't really understand that history. I learned growing up, but I do have to admit my education was more of a Reader's Digest version, that Lincoln was a lawyer who became president, then freed the slaves with the Emancipation Proclamation. Then there was a quick war and the 13th Amendment happened. I didn't learn until I was much older that the Emancipation Proclamation only freed the slaves in states taking part in the rebellion. And I was much older when I learned that the 13th Amendment isn't clear-cut as clear-cut as I once thought it was, regardless of when it was ratified by whichever state you want to look at. When I was a kid, I thought the 13th Amendment said something like this, that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist within the United States or any place subject to the jurisdiction, which I think personally sounds pretty good, but in fact, that is not the case. In reality, the 13th Amendment reads as follows, that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude except as punishment for a crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted shall exist within the United States or any place subject to the jurisdiction. Do you hear the difference? It's that one line in the middle. Except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted. So in reality, the 13th Amendment didn't abolish slavery. It just recategorized the slaves. Yet we don't see slave auctions anymore. So where are they? Which brings me to the founding of Parchment Farm. The story begins in 1900. Mississippi was struggling for revenue after the Civil War, having at this still not ratified the 13th Amendment, decided to use penal farms on state land to bolster the economy. The farms were set up like the traditional plantations of the pre-Civil War era. This was the project of Governor James Vardaman. Regarding that project, the Mississippi Encyclopedia says this about Vardaman's plan. The undeveloped penal farm was a possible solution to the problem of what he called criminal Negroes who were migrating to the state's cities seeking a way to live without honest toil and menacing the safety of the white man's home. So it was the early 20th century, but don't mistake his tone. He was not just a racist, but an avid white supremacist. In fact, he referred back to the state's 1890 Constitution, saying this: "There is no use to equivocate or lie about the matter. Mississippi's Constitutional Convention of 1890 was held for no other purpose than to eliminate," and he uses the N-word, "from politics. Not the ignorant or the vicious, as some apologists would have you believe, but," and he says the N-word again, "let the world know just as it is. In Mississippi, we have in our Constitution legislated against the racial peculiarities of the Negro. When that device fails, we will resort to something else." What is clear is that Vardaman utilizes the prison system, as was allowed by the 13th Amendment, to reinstitute slavery in Mississippi. The Mississippi state prison system was created to and has always served to control African American people and culture, and it did. Even though this was taking place in Mississippi, it was part of a shift of national politics being bolstered by the failure of what Reverend William Barber II called the First Reconstruction. I wonder sometimes if the Yankee and carpetbaggers had not bungled Reconstruction, what Mississippi would look like today. Because the failure of Reconstruction was partially due to the opportunists from the North taking advantage of Southern poverty. In doing so, they were able to mobilize poor whites against poor blacks. Though I wouldn't say that the last 100 years have been a failure, I would bring you back to what Governor Vardaman said: "When that device fails, organized segregation through prison systems, we will resort to something else." And they did. Which brings me to the Republican strategist Lee Atwater in the Southern strategy of a post-Jim Crow racial politic. Atwater points out that the conservative can't get away with saying the same things anymore. In this article was, or this interview ran in the late 70s, early 80s. The idea for Atwater was very similar in language to what Vardaman had said. The idea was to talk about forced busing and states' rights, weaving economic tax cuts to social programs as necessary to balance a budget, knowing that it will hurt certain people without saying so. Ronald Reagan doubled down on this in Neshoba County in Mississippi during the Neshoba County Fair in the 1980 election. Talking about states' rights, law and order, and regularly using the phrase "welfare queens." Over time, following this trend, Michelle Alexander in her book, The New Jim Crow, points out that this language is embedded in the war on drugs of the 1980s, pointing out that prior to the war on drugs, less than 2% of the American people believed drugs were a big problem. In fact, local police forces didn't initially buy into the war on drugs until the creation of a federal program that allowed local police forces to keep that money and that came with the drug busts. And those busts and later convictions were more common in African American communities, even though drug use was consistent across the board with blacks and whites. Later, they would weigh the conviction of certain drugs that were common in black neighborhoods, for example, crack versus cocaine, causing a higher rate of felony convictions for African Americans against whites, and in doing so, restricting the vote of poor blacks. This is all in Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. In doing this, they raised the number of African Americans in prison labor forces while decreasing the number of African American voters. Now, with the privatization of prisons, inmates are once again sold as commodities on auction. Or maybe the auctions never stopped. Just as Vardaman said, they resorted to something else. In the last 20 years, this something has been referred to by many as mass incarceration. But in reality, Mississippi has been practicing mass incarceration with permission since the failure of the first Reconstruction. Prisons like Parchman worked so well in the first half of the 20th century because there was no parole or probation. They could round people up and keep them for a lifetime. They did, making more agreeable trustees of the prison, directly overseeing other prisoners. This was free labor since they were prisoners, and the job benefited the trustees in small ways. They didn't have to work in the fields, and they had a sliver of authority over others. But after 1956, older trustees were being released. The price of cotton, their main cash crop, dropped, and they lost the free labor part of the management program. They addressed this by building a maximum security prison in the gas chamber. I would walk you through generation by generation of Parchman Prison, but all you will hear were demands for reform and promised reforms that never happened. In the last 2 weeks, shocking videos have been raised from Parchman Prison. It has now been made public that the prison itself is no longer under the control of its guards. We will have heard that Block 32, which was to be closed in 2011, after the ACLU sued, was reopened without any repairs. In fact, the uprising that took place in the prison was in Block 32, though it was supposed to be closed. The men living in Parchman Prison live without air conditioning, without reasonable meals, and without means for hygiene. Photos have been leaked from the inside, photos of dilapidation, rats lying dead on the floor, food that I wouldn't feed my dog, and inmates sleeping on the floor, sleeping in water that was leaked in after the rains, and inmates being kept like animals. Actually, no. In Mississippi, it's against the state law to treat animals that way. I had to stop looking at the pictures that came out. In the last week, before writing this sermon alone, 5 inmates had died. And since then, we have lost multiple due to hangings and other deaths. 3 of those inmates were killed in Parchman during a riot that was live streamed to the internet by another inmate. Since writing this sermon, there have been more. And one of the most important things, as we listened to the governor's comments a few days ago about actually going to visit Parchman, he articulated that the main problem in Parchman Prison were the cell phones. But as it would be stated by many people at many rallies I've been to, thank God for the cell phones. The governor wants to remove the cell phones from the prison because without the cell phones, no one outside the prison would see what is happening inside the prison. For him, the fix is doing what Mississippi has done for over 100 years, and that is to keep the prisoners quiet and to not let anybody know what is happening inside that prison. After the riot, inmates went missing because guard towers are empty. 65% of the guards are women, and there are so few that the gangs are left to do their own policing. When asked why most of the guards are women, one staffer replied, "The men won't take the jobs." Starting at $26,000 a year for well over 40 hours a week doesn't sound like a very good job to put your life on the line for anyway. The fact is, neither inmate or guard are safe in Parchment Prison, and this is not new information. Block 32 was closed 10 years ago, yet that is where the maximum security and death row inmates are kept. Since the war on drugs in the 1980s, incarceration rates have grown from 500,000 to 2.5 million, according to organizations like Human Rights Watch and researchers like Michelle Alexander. Those numbers are connected. Then add the fact that in 2010, African Americans made up 40% of the prison population, even though they only make up 13% of the national population. According to Wikipedia, 51% of inmates are being held for nonviolent crime. But let's not stop there. According to the Clarion Ledger, Mississippi has what's called restitution centers. Another word for these could be debtors' prisons. There are at least four across Mississippi, and local businesses can rent people from them for the day at minimum wage by the hour to be paid for to the state as they pay down a financial debt to Mississippi. You can actually download a map telling you which companies are renting prisoners. And remember, the prisoners take nothing home with them. Instead, all of that money goes to the state. So it may be a McDonald's, a Waffle House, or a construction company. Pretty much anyone that has use for employees and the money to rent the inmates. And while this is happening, remember, if it wasn't for the inmates, these places would actually need to hire people at competitive wages. And while this is happening, and I can go on, I've got a very large file of articles just from Mississippi alone that has grown over and wider since this time. But we would be saying the same thing over and over again. I have watched the video, I have looked at the pictures, and there is a lot to go through. And I haven't even started quoting past inmates, guards, or family members of the dead. The thing is, there is a great word to describe this system, and it is not generally permissible from a pulpit to say, but it starts with an F. Which is a good way to introduce what I believe the theological core of this sermon is. Alan Lomax, described as an ethnomusicologist, traveled through the American South regarding folk music and found himself at Parchment Farm in 1947 and 48. During that time, he recorded field callers and songs of the men working the cotton fields. In fact, that was I played one of those songs, No More My Lord, earlier in this service. His recordings are very important to understanding the history of music in the United States and Europe, but it still strikes me as a theological tone that you can buy these things in albums now. We have found another way to monetize the work of inmates. Psalm 137 in the Bible says this. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, and there we wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows, there we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs, and our tormentors asked for mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. This is a post-exilic psalm from the Hebrew Bible, meaning that it was written while Israel was in exile in Babylon. It tells the story of people being transported to another land as prisoners, and during that time being asked to sing their songs of joy while exiled from the home that they loved. A 1970s reggae band called the Melodians used this verse to sing a song about government oppression in Jamaica. And I believe there is a theological connection between the biblical Psalms like 137 and the chain gang chants like "No More My Lord" or "Poor Lazarus." They are sung by people in exile, and over time, somewhere we have found a way to monetize that. Now, there is another side to that story where these songs become beacons of hope, but as I listen, a white man knowing the history of the song, "No More My Lord," knowing where it was recorded in the name of the person who led it, knowing that those men lived in post-Civil War legal slavery, I have to ask, is my identification with that song anything more than that of the Babylonians asking the Israelites to sing songs of joy in exile? I remember a lifetime of choir concerts. It was fashionable as I grew up for school choirs to sing African-American spirituals, and as an adult, I often wonder who I am in this situation. Am I the Israelite or am I the Babylonian? Isaiah 61 is one of the most popular verses in Christian scripture, especially in December and January. Jesus quotes it in Luke when he begins his ministry, and it seems like someone always quotes it at the rallies I attend. In some ways, it lays out the mission even of our faith, whether you find hope in Christian scripture or not. Regardless of that, it defines what faith actually is and lays out the purpose of religion and the core of spirituality. And it says this: "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because He has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight to the blind, to set the oppressed free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Which is much more poetic, but in the same family of, we affirm that all human beings ought to be treated with dignity. And I think those are in the same ballpark. There are many organizations currently working on our mass incarceration issues in the United States, and they have some great ideas. But before we do any of that, we must remember mass incarceration is a justice issue, it's a racial issue, it's rooted in white supremacy, and it is legal. And let me be clear, mass incarceration is slavery. Many of you already know about the conditions in Parchment, and if you didn't, I hope you do some research. But remember, Parchment isn't the only prison, and it may not actually even be the worst. As we consider the words by the rivers of Babylon, I ask you to consider the hearts of the people who penned Psalms that may ask, who are we in this situation? And who are the people living in exile today? And when someone asks you what it means to be you, you remember the words of Isaiah as they were spoken by Jesus in Luke. "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because He has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight to the blind, to set the oppressed free." As we go forth from this place today, as we go to our homes, remember that some will be returning to homes that are locked behind metal. Some will be returning to homes where they feel unsafe. And some people are in places they cannot leave, whether they deserve it or not.